Today I am going to start with major transitions in my life, and so that this can be used as a way of querying what one did within each transition period. I was born in 1937. For the first 9 years of my life, I was in Khartoum, mostly, and that's the village I believe I was born in, and then went from there in 1946 to Kalahasti to go to school. I was in Kalahasti in elementary school for 3 years, and then in the 46, 47, 48, finishing up in 49 to 50, 51, beginning years, and that finished in 52, summer. So I was there from 1946 to 1952 in Kalahasti, going to first elementary school for 3 years and high school for 3 years. For a total of six, and they were called first form, second form, and third form, the sixth, seventh, and eighth grades, and fourth, fifth, and sixth forms, which were ninth, tenth, and eleventh grades. Since then, the education program has been changed. So from 52 to 54, I was in Loyola College, and from 54 to 58, I was in Engineering College, Guindy. In 58, I worked for 6 months in Madras Port Trust. And in December of 1958, I left for Australia with my friends Krishnamurthy Bekal, BK, and Chandy John. The three of us were there for I believe at least 4 years, and I left from Australia in 1963 to come to USA, to Stanford. But during that period, I first went to college, to University of New South Wales, to get a master's degree. That was roughly 1 year, December to December of, or January to January of 1959 and 60. And from 61 to 63, or 60 to 63, December 60 to 63, I was with IBM World Trade Corporation, primarily in Sydney and then in Canberra, in different positions. So at that time I was not going to school, so I'd be happy to talk about what happened during that period, 1961 to 63. And in 63, I left and came to USA, mainly to go to Stanford. But along the way, I went first to Hong Kong, and from Hong Kong to Madras, and from Madras to USA, and that is New York City, where I went to visit IBM Research for a while, for a day or two, and from there I went to Stanford. So I was in Stanford from 1963 to 1969 for 6 years. The first 3 years I was a student, then I finished my PhD in 1966. And from 66 to 69, I was an assistant professor at Stanford. And so those are two periods there. From 69 to now, I've been at CMU. The main transitions at CMU are, I became a full professor in 1973. Then I was, started the Robotics Institute in 1979, And in 1984, no, even in 1980, I also did this French Centre Mondial experiment, and which in 1984 I was made a university professor, and in 1991 I became the dean, and from 79 to 91 I was the director of Robotics Institute. And 91 to 99, I was the dean of the School of Computer Science. Then in 2001, for 3 years, I went to West Coast campus on a part-time basis to help to get it started. And I came back again in 2004. And 2004 to 2006, I've been kind of working on India projects, curriculum and various other things. Although I continue to be a professor at CMU. So those kind of represent various transitions and are probably appropriate as specific targets for information extraction or questioning. In the form of what, who, where, when, and so on. And so now what I'll do is start with the period when I was working for the Madras Port Trust after I graduated. I was in the job only for a few months, I believe. And so one of the curious things about that job was, you know, in order to find a job those days, you had to have a recommendation. But in this particular case, I didn't have any recommendation. I just went and talked to the executive engineer in charge of the department, said, "I'm available, I'm looking for a job." And fortunately, he took an interest and gave me a job. And the problem, the job was, you know, most of the jobs there, when you start, they give you something boring to do, like drafting. And that's what I was doing most of the time. But my feeling was, I need not have studied all those things I studied just to be drafting. I could have done it after 1 month of training, right after school. So the question is, why the hell am I wasting my time doing drafting for months on end on some boring things? Sure, there's probably a lot of experience you need to get in drafting. The question is, when is the right time to do it? Is it after you've spent 4 years learning all kinds of esoteric subjects and then be told to spend a year doing nothing more than drafting of some simple construction site of constructing a port or something? And that's one of the problems with the educational systems of today. They teach you a lot of stuff because they have you captive for a period of 4 years or so, most of which turns out to be irrelevant in life, and many of them are never practiced. But what you do get to practice, you could have learned and used without having to waste 4 years of time. So therein lies the conundrum of how to structure future educational systems. So in any case, in December of 1958, three of us went off to Australia as exchange students, and that was the main exit point. I left from India at that time. I think I was about, 21 years old. And ever since then, I've been abroad. And there's a story associated with that. And it turns out, you know, if you want to go to Australia, which is what we applied for this exchange student program that they had. You had to get a visa. In order to get a visa, you had to have an x-ray and other things taken to make sure that your health is okay, you're not carrying any communicable diseases. When they took my x-ray, they said, you know, this person certainly has TB. And it turns out I was a kind of healthy person, so I didn't have TB. So I said, this is obviously a false diagnosis. So I took it to TB Sanatorium in Thambaram, where one of my friends was a doctor. And he and others looked at it and said, these are calcified spots, but it looks like you must have had TB sometime before. And I said, no, I never had TB. So it looks like I might have caught it, but fought it off and never really seriously had to deal with it. But that signature was there. And however, to get into Australia, they wouldn't have let me in into Australia with that x-ray. So then they asked me to take another x-ray. But this time, the spots were not that clearly visible. And I said, what happened? He said, it's a question of what the exposure is set at. And if you set it at very light, you know, things that are dormant may show up as active, and that's what happened in the first one. Anyway, whatever, I don't know much about x-rays, but I was lucky enough to kind of get through and was able to kind of travel with my friends all the way to Australia. So that was the travel to Australia was also an interesting experience. The first time we were setting out of India. So it turned out we could have taken Air India from Madras to Singapore to Melbourne directly, but the cost would have been 1,800 rupees at that time. This was in 1958. And on the other hand, if we went by boat and train to Singapore, from there if we caught a plane, the cost would have been only 1,280. So we would have saved 600 rupees, which is was a lot of money those days. I think it was like $200, given the exchange rate, $250. All the three of us decided we don't need to rush there that in a hurry. We will just take extra time and go by boat. And so going in the boat was a great experience. We were traveling by third class. That meant there were no beds. You kind of brought your own bed. You kind of slept on the deck. And there were lots of other people. It was teeming with people. And somehow it didn't make any difference because we're used to sleeping under those conditions in villages and houses and so on. So we managed without any problem. So we landed in port city of Penang. From Penang in Malaysia, we had to go to Singapore, and that leg we did by train. And for the first time, we were traveling by train. And as luck would have it, this was a sleeper train, and they had beautiful beds and clean sheets and everything. We thought we were in the lap of luxury. And then we went to Singapore. There was one other person that was traveling with the three of us, who was a doctoral student, Krishnan, whose family was in Singapore. So they kindly hosted us for a few days before we had to catch the plane to go to Melbourne, and that was an interesting experience of visiting this family and then also seeing Singapore. At that time, it was still a sleepy little town, was not yet the business center of the world, and was an interesting experience. And from Singapore, we, after 3-4 days of staying there, we boarded the plane to Melbourne, and so along the way, when we landed in the city in the north of Australia, it'll come to me, it's not Dublin, it starts with a D, Darwin, yeah, Darwin or something like that. Anyway, and since that was north in the tropics along next to Indonesia, it was extremely hot. So we said, my God, this is just like India. And then we got on the plane, and the next stop was Melbourne, where we were landing. This was, you know, we landed in Melbourne, and somewhere one of the people that was part of the program came and received us. But in Melbourne, the temperature was extremely cold. So here we were, and we didn't have any jackets or anything, you know, and it was very cold and we were freezing. So the temperature change was dramatic, and that was the first time we noticed that things can get pretty cold. So that is the end of arrival in Australia. And for the first year, I spent time in Australia, in Melbourne, and then went to, at the end of the year, to, this was 59, all of 59 I was in Melbourne. In December of 59, I went to Sydney to restart or join as a student to do a master's program at the University of New South Wales. So that's the beginning of that part of the journey. I'm now talking about the 1 year in transition in 1958 and mostly 59 in Melbourne, Australia. I went there as an exchange student from India. An exchange student was someone who was already still a student when he was selected. He's going to another country, in this case Australia, which had this program, to, you know, learn by apprenticeship some of the profession, and then become and then go on to some profession after that's finished. So the apprenticeship or a practical experience as an exchange student was supposed to happen in 59. So, in my case, since my undergraduate degree was in civil engineering, I was kind of assigned to the Victoria, state of Victoria, had roads, called CRB, Country Roads Board, to essentially, which actually was responsible for construction of the roads throughout the state. And in that particular case, I was kind of working for another engineer who was building bridges. So we were in bridge design. But mostly, since I was just an exchange student, they didn't expect me to do a lot of work. And I guess I didn't do any, because I was mostly learning about the environment and the place and different culture and different people and all the rest of it. So what I did at work is still kind of very much of a haze. And I'm sure I did something, whatever needed to be done. But there was no ownership, and there was also no direct commitment, because this was a temporary assignment or a temporary position I had taken, for it would only be for a year. And given that temporary nature, they also seem to think, since I'm not a permanent employee, they don't have to worry about how I dealt with it. And so they kind of left me, gave me substantial freedom. And there were two or three very interesting incidents that turned out to be important and interesting. One was we had a boss, Irvin, and he was not very happy about people talking on the job. So, you know, people would kind of pick up the phone and call their family or brothers or sisters or somebody else and talk. And then he would kind of look at the people talking on the phone and squint because he said, you should be working, you know, this is not your private phone. But he never quite said it that way. I wish he had, because, you know, if somebody had told me that when you're at work, you're not allowed to take private phone calls. If you must call them, then you should do it in your own time, kind of thing, which is okay. But I was not told, neither were others. And so basically many others were reprimanded, apparently, and I didn't know that. So one day I was talking, and then I was called by Irvin to his office and said, you know, where he was, you know, he kind of said, you know, you can't do this and this. And so that became a major incident. Fortunately, nothing happened. But I said, okay, you know. And so in general, it becomes important for people to know what they are allowed and not allowed to do. And one simple way would have been if there were a set of do's and don'ts that are on a piece of paper that were handed out to new employees. Otherwise, they wouldn't know what is approved, accepted, and what is not accepted. And most people will follow the rules if they're told that that's the rule. Otherwise, you find people taking, making various allowances, since they're all being paid for that time, it is only fair to expect them to work. But you know, people don't know that. They know that they're expected to work, but they don't know that they're not allowed to do other things. So that was one. The second interesting thing, which I didn't realize then, but I had realized since then, is by the time I went there, there were a lot of Europeans from the Eastern Europe that were displaced because of the Second World War that were in Melbourne. And one of them was Irvin, and he was from Yugoslavia. There was also a lady there. She was from Hungary. And it was an interesting group of people. When I saw them, I didn't know that they were any different than other white people. But it turned out to be an interesting set of groups of people at that time. And so I was there for a whole year and tried to be helpful. The living arrangements were also quite interesting. I was staying in a separate room in one of the houses. There was a couple, and the lady was already, she was a Scientologist. You know, at that time, Scientology now is a major controversial religion, type of, you know, religious following. But in those days, it was not that well known. But the interesting thing about it, I believe, is it's a mixture of Eastern and Western religions, you know, where you believe in reincarnation, you believe in, you know, what you observe is in this life is a consequence of the previous lives. And all these people try to go back and experience the previous lives and talk to other people in the previous lives and so on. So it's kind of somewhat mystical following, and people follow these things. So those of us who are from Hinduism or Buddhism don't find this too strange, but many others, like that are, who are Christians, would find this difficult to understand what it is. And what. So her husband, Keith, was advertising executive in a newspaper, and what he would do every day would be to kind of get all the ads that had to be placed and lay them out on the newspaper and then use them, and then he would kind of look at the newspaper ads from their paper and other papers to see, get ideas on what they might do the next time around. So, and then we also had a community of people. There were some girls who had come from Sri Lanka. In those days it used to be called Ceylon, still, I believe. And these girls were nurses trainees. They were there to be trained as nurses, and many of them have since gone back to either Sri Lanka or stayed in Australia or went to England, whatever that may be. Where they were there, and then there were many of us, boys, and all of the people used to kind of regularly get together and have mostly harmless fun. And it was an interesting 1 year in Melbourne. Melbourne has a big bay, and we would kind of go around the bay to see what else was there, and on the other side of the bay. And I didn't have a car at that time, but one of my other friends had a car, so we all used to drive around in their car, and then I would just take the tram or bus to work, and everything was kind of reasonably interesting. And in December of 1959, I left Melbourne to join the M.Tech program in the University of New South Wales, and we'll talk about that in our next recording.